listening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Things in Eldoret are one of pandemonium. People are excited.
That's Lenny Ruvaga reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, the number of foreign fighters joining extremist groups continues to rise in North Africa and the Sahel region. And political tensions are climbing in South Africa as Parliament begins debating a motion to impeach President Jacob Zuma.
We'll have these stories and more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the International Criminal Court has dropped charges that Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto. The ICC says today that the judges voted 2-1 to vacate charges of crimes against humanity. Mr. Ruto had denied charges of murder, deportation, and persecution during the violence of the 2007 national elections in which 1,200 people died. Ruto's lawyers argue that he should have been acquitted because so many key prosecution witnesses have either dropped or changed their original statements. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda had acknowledged the loss of witnesses has weakened the case, but she has argued there still remains enough evidence to proceed with the trial.
Following today's international court ruling in Geneva, Switzerland, VOA's John Tanza talked to reporter Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi about Kenyan government reaction to the ICC decision to drop all charges against Kenya's deputy president.
That the Song case has been terminated without prejudice to re-prosecution in future. And what this means that essentially the case has been closed. And the scene in Nairobi is one of calmness. However, in Eldoret, which, as you well know, is the stronghold of the deputy president, William Samoei Ruto, and the broadcaster, Sang, this is where they hail from. This is largely where the ethnic community comes from, the Rift Valley. So scenes in Eldoret are one of pandemonium. People are excited, and we've had sporadic people going to the streets, chanting songs in praise of both the deputy president and indeed the broadcaster Sang.
Initially, rights groups in East Africa, especially the community-based activists in Nairobi, were praising hard that President Kenyatta and his deputy have to face justice for the alleged crimes committed during the post-election violence. How are the civil society groups reacting to this news?
It's quite instructive to realize that the civil society in Kenya is split across political divide. Now, it depends on which side the bread is buttered. Indeed, the International Commission of Jurists have said that the quest for justice, and if I can quote them, the executive director, Mr. Sam Muhochi, has said the quest for justice for the victims and the IDPs has come to an end, and they will not get any recompense whatsoever. So it's a sad day for them, and I had a chat with him a few minutes ago, and this was his stand. However, Okiya Omtatah, a different civil rights activist who has been against the ICC and its processes from the beginning, his heart has said that indeed it is a day of jubilation.
And how is the reaction in Central Province, where President Uhuru Kenyatta comes from?
Now, in Central Province, the reaction is calm, just like Nairobi. You do realize that the people who were on the stand were coming. The other four have been acquitted, indeed. And when the president was let go, Central Province erupted, you know, unanimously and sporadically in jubilation. And this is exactly what we're seeing now in Eldoret. In Central Province, their reaction is muted and calm, although they were also pushing here politically and also judicially to have the cases dropped and were throwing all their weight behind the deputy president and indeed Sang. So in Central Province, to answer your question, is that it's one of calmness, but it's a restrained calmness, and they too indeed are happy about this.
And how about the other political forces in the country? How is the reaction from the camp of ODM, Raila Odinga and the rest?
The ODM camp has been mute for the moment, but I don't expect this to be so in the next hour. They have been mute, no press statements from them. No political heavyweight has come to the screen to give a press conference. So no one as yet from the court opposition side has come either to support or to lambast the decision by the ICC. As of now, no one has reacted from the opposition side. I gather and I tend to think that they're putting their collective heads together to come up with a more comprehensive political statement, because indeed the ruling has got ramifications, not just now, Mr. Tanza, but you do realize that Kenya is going to an election next year, so this ruling has got ramifications across the divide on the electoral system, the judiciary system, and also the state security machinery.
And that's Lani Ruvaga reporting from Nairobi.
Flows of foreign fighters to extremist groups continue to rise in North Africa and the Sahel region, and especially to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. These new forces threaten Africa with even more security challenges than ever. Among those following developments is Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. Our senior Middle East reporter, Mohammed Al-Shanawi, asked him about what's driving the rise of violent extremism in North Africa and the Sahel.
First, many of the places where we're seeing growing violent extremism are marginalized areas across the North Africa and the Sahel, places that are relatively worse off, and people are feeling left behind and excluded on the part of their governments. And so this creates a sense of grievance among these communities, which, when exploited by local political actors, has mobilized these grievances into support for violent militant activity. And so I think you need the combination of both the grievances as well as the local actors who we can call spoilers, or people who stir up these grievances and direct it towards violent activity. And then I would add a third category, which is the ideological influences, often which are coming from outside the region. It's part of a broader global phenomenon, which we've been seeing over the last several decades, often very conservative Islamic ideological influences from the Gulf, which have been trying to imprint and reshape interpretations of Islam across the Muslim world, really. And so over time, it has promoted a more militant attitude among youth, which, when coupled with the other factors of grievances and a sense of exploitation, has fostered a greater receptivity to these violent extremist messages.
What do violent extremists in this region have in common? You have ISIS, Boko Haram, Ansar al-Sharia, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and other extremist groups.
I think it's important to recognize that many of these groups are different, and that they each have organized themselves and come about in different ways. You have a group like Boko Haram, which did emerge from a local, homegrown sense of trying to defend interest within parts of northern Nigeria, and which spoke to this sense of grievance that many of these communities felt. Over time, that evolved into something that became more violent over time. And more recently, it has largely left its ideological roots and become more of an opportunistic criminal group. But nonetheless, there's a strong local dimension to where Boko Haram came from. I think AQIM has, we've seen, you know, a migration of influences from Algeria into Mali and other parts of the Sahel. And there has been some effort to link up with local groups to try to gain more influence and some sustainability. And ISIS, I think, has really come in lately, and they don't have deep roots on the continent. They, too, are trying to link up with certain militant groups in North Africa, primarily, especially in Libya, to try to give them a foothold in the region. So I think the origins and the way that these groups have organized themselves are all different. I think they are all trying to appeal to the sense of grievance among local Muslim communities, especially youth, and trying to use an ideological call to violence as a way of defending their interest against this sense that they are being exploited and excluded from the current governance arrangements. I would add that, you know, while there's a strong ideological call to try to reach youth, you know, who feel discontented for whatever reason, there's also a financial attraction. You know, we're often talking about areas that are quite poor, where job opportunities are limited, and these groups are offering some payments for membership and for participating in their activities. And so in some places, that's a pretty strong pull. And certainly there's some suggestion in the case of Boko Haram that it's the financial elements now that are the main driver and the main appeal for youth to join the group rather than any of their ideological messages.
That was Joseph Siegel, Research Director at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
President Barack Obama met yesterday with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, the White House, to discuss possible expansion of operations to support Libya and the region in combating the growing threat of Islamic State forces. Stoltenberg says Western forces have made progress in their support of a UN-backed effort to restore a government of unity in Libya's capital, Tripoli. Mr. Obama says NATO's continued to be the cornerstone of a collective defense and U.S. security policy.
The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists is leading the investigation of millions of leaked documents that implicate dozens of world leaders and wealthy elites of tax evasion. Now called the Panama Papers, the documents were leaked from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca and show how dozens of country leaders and wealthy elites have used offshore and hidden accounts to create a loophole for dodging taxes and sanctions. Ian Bohr has more.
It's being called the biggest documents leak in history. Over 11 million internal papers from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca, who specializes in creating offshore companies, have connected at least 140 politicians from more than 50 countries of quietly establishing offshore companies and potentially evading taxes. Former Sudanese President Ahmad al-Mirghani, who was ousted after just 2 years in office by President Omar al-Bashir, has been implicated in the Panama Papers. J.R. Maley, a policy analyst at the Washington, D.C.-based Enough Project, says there are all kinds of reasons why a powerful individual would purchase an offshore company.
So it's not just tax evasion. A wide range of individuals use these sorts of entities, from people who have to do it for completely legitimate purposes, like, you know, perhaps property developers who are trying to stave off price gouging, to a wide range of nefarious purposes. So there are folks that use these sorts of entities for sanctions busting, for, you know, siphoning off money from state coffers in the case of politicians. You know, essentially anyone who wants to hide what their economic dealings are has a use for anonymous shell companies, and that's the crux of the problem.
Al-Mirghani purchased Orange Star Corporation in 1995, a company located in the British Virgin Islands. That same year, the ousted president, who was exiled to Egypt, purchased a string of apartments for $600,000 near Hyde Park in London. At the time of his death in 2008, the Panama Papers report that Al-Mirghani held assets through the Orange Star Corporation for more than $2.7 million. Maley cautions there is not enough evidence to accuse al-Mirghani or any of his associates of any illegal activities.
You know, he used an anonymous shell company to purchase about $600,000 worth of real estate in London. You know, that in itself isn't very shocking, but whenever you're considering the activities of a current or former head of state, when there is an anonymous shell company involved to conceal the transaction, that should trigger alarm bells and should trigger enhanced scrutiny by any other parties involved in those transactions.
Mossack Fonseca is one of the leading creators of shell companies, according to the Center for Public Integrity. Maley warns that these offshore companies are not illegal.
To be sure, there may be instances where it's appropriate for folks to want to, you know, hide where they own a home, for example. However, when a senior politician or their immediate family member uses an anonymous shell company to conceal transactions in which they're involved, that should immediately trigger alarm bells and extra scrutiny.
Former President Ahmad Ahmadghani is the only African leader directly implicated in the leak. The Panama Papers has implicated six other African leaders through relations with colleagues or family. For example, Alha Mubarak, the son of former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, also bought an offshore company through Mossack Fonseca. Munir Mahidi, the personal secretary to the King of Morocco, has also been named in the papers, as has the nephew of South African President Jacob Zuma. Mossack Fonseca has denied any wrongdoing. The law firm says the majority of their clients are regulated entities and insists that all of them are well-known and reputable companies and firms. Ayen Buer, VOA News, Washington.
Turkey says 78 Syrian refugees left by plane for Europe today. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu announced the results of a second-day delivery of refugees to Europe. The flights are part of a European Union-Turkish agreement to try to manage this year's refugee crisis in Europe. The Dutch Justice Minister says 31 refugees are to land in the Netherlands. However, authorities in Greece say they have paused reciprocal deportations by boat to Turkey. On Monday, an estimated 202 migrants from 11 countries were sent back to Turkey from the Greek islands of Lesbos and Chios. Officials on the island of Chios said more migrants could be sent back from there Wednesday. The International Office for Migration says over 172,000 migrants and refugees have reached Europe by sea this year. The figures include small numbers of migrants arriving in Cyprus and Spain, as well as the busier routes connecting Turkey to Greece and North Africa to Italy. Turkish Coast Guard officials say 55 migrants hoping to reach Europe were apprehended on the first day of the agreement.
Conflict, civil strife, and poor rainy seasons have further reduced crop production in South Sudan, causing people to experience severe food shortages. The Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Food Program, WFP, warn in a joint release that the country is experiencing a cereal deficit of 381,000 tons, which is a 53% higher deficit than last year. In addition, soaring food prices are contributing to the collapse of markets, with nearly half of the country's population unsure of where their next meal will come from. Chalice McDonough is a spokesperson for the World Food Program. She spoke with me about the contributing factors that have led to alarming levels of hunger in South Sudan.
So this is really a combination of three pretty serious factors. One of them is, of course, the conflict. And that has been having a dangerous effect on South Sudan's food security since it began. And then combined with that, there is an economic crisis that the conflict has brought along with it that has made it much harder for people, even in places that aren't directly affected by fighting, to be able to afford to get enough food to eat. And then on top of that, this past year, the rains were not great in parts of the country where they depend on the agricultural production as sort of breadbasket of the country. And so you saw a lot of people, because they knew the rains were coming late, that they were not good, they reduced the area of land that they planted, or what they did plant didn't grow and didn't produce much of a harvest.
So what are people experiencing when they go and try to purchase food? Is it just so high they can't get it?
In a lot of places, that's exactly what we're seeing. And we're hearing of people complaining of that, even in Juba, the capital, which is one of the most sort of stable and prosperous parts of the country. We're hearing some pretty worrying reports to that effect in other kind of urban areas as well, up in the north. And people have found that food prices have been skyrocketing. So, for example, cereal prices have increased nearly 5 times since the beginning of 2015. Can you imagine people's salaries or what they earn from their businesses have not increased along with that? So people are really struggling to be able to stretch their income enough to get the food that their family needs to eat.
And you mentioned earlier that some of the areas that were stable areas are even experiencing this. So this is pretty much spreading throughout the country?
It really has. And that's been one of the saddest things to note over the last year in particular, is this sort of generalization of the food crisis to most of the country. So there are places that have been traditionally stable that haven't been previously directly affected by conflict, where insecurity has gotten worse and where the economic crisis and the poor rains have also combined to give people a pretty hard time in making ends meet. So it's a really worrying trend. The key, I think, to resolving this is that the conflict really does have to end in practice on the ground soon so that people can go back to rebuilding their lives.
And in the meantime, what is being done now to help people?
Well, we are working with our partners to try to reach 3 million people this year with food assistance and specialized nutritional support. And in areas that are stable enough, we're trying to help communities actually be better prepared to deal with things like poor rain so that they don't necessarily lose their harvest. In other areas, we're just doing essentially emergency food assistance, trying to basically just keep people alive. And it's a tremendous undertaking. It's logistically incredibly complicated, and we have to overcome a lot of obstacles when it comes to security. We've been managing in a sort of a really extraordinary humanitarian response over the last several years, but it's very clear that that's going to have to be sustained, especially if the conflict doesn't end, because the food security situation continues to deteriorate as long as this crisis goes on.
So then what do you see in the months ahead if things continue this way?
Well, we're really worried about actually the months ahead, because the rainy season has ended and the dry season is starting. Then each season brings a particular set of hazards. In the rainy season, there are sort of danger from disease, including malaria or cholera. But people have access, particularly in kind of rural areas or the areas that have been most directly affected by conflict, they have access to wild foods like fish, or, you know, can scrounge by, can manage to scrounge a living on, you know, water lily bulbs or other wild foods. In the dry season, those wild foods are much harder to come by. So people have a much harder time getting by if we can't assist them. And so I think the important thing is that we have to be able to continue to reach people during the dry season, and that we don't see what we've seen in previous dry seasons as an upsurge in the conflict and the fighting.
Chalice McDonough is a spokesperson for the World Food Program. She spoke with me from Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
VOA Africa.